Mark Brewer as former chair of the Michigan Democratic Party. Jeff Timmer as former executive director of the Michigan Republicans. And this is a Republic, if you can keep it, with Mark Brewer and Jeff Timmer.
I'm Mark Brewer. Thanks for joining us this week on A Republic, if you can keep it. Later in the podcast, we'll talk Michigan policy priorities with Lieutenant Governor Garland Gilchrist.
I'm Jeff Timmer. Before we talk to the Lieutenant Governor, Mark and I, let's talk about some legitimate political discourse that's happened this last week. And there has been, you know, quite a bit for those who are following the various news and scandals and fake electors and all of that business in Michigan. Yesterday we saw the state police reportedly in conjunction with the attorney general's office raid the home very publicly and in loud fashion, lots of cars, lots of uniformed police raiding the home of former Speaker Lee Chatfield's top staffers, Rob Menard and his wife, Ann Menard, who were the custodians of all these millions of dollars of PAC money and dark C4 money and whatnot. And boy, this really looks like the shit is hitting the fan when it comes to not just the criminal sexual scandal involving the former speaker, but what appears to be a lot of movement in the financial related scandals related to the former speaker and all those who are associated with him.
Yeah, I think that's right, Jeff. But those of us who follow these kinds of things, this raid was no surprise, given how prominent the Menards are in the middle of all of this. Like you said, the C4, the PACs, they have their own consulting business, which they may have run out of the state house offices. And one of them is still on the state payroll. I see that their attorney complained about the fact that there was no notice. Well, you know, if you're doing something like this, you don't give them notice because that enables people to destroy evidence. So, again, no surprise. It looks like they hauled away quite a bit of material, including some computers. So we'll see what comes up next in terms of what they start looking at, whether there'll be other raids. Who are they talking to in the attorney general and the state police about all of this? It's been very, very quiet from the state house front, right? Almost eerily so. You know, Wentworth got away with several weeks ago saying, well, we're not going to do our own investigation because there's this ongoing outside investigation. I don't know how much longer that's going to hold. It shouldn't hold because I think there needs to be a thorough investigation inside the house of what Chatfield was doing with that multi-million dollar house budget that only he controlled. There could be a lot of abuses there. We've seen abuses in the past by both Democrats and Republicans because that money is not subject to any accountability, no oversight. It's like a personal piggy bank for the speaker and in the Senate for the majority leader. So we'll have to see how this unfolds. It does look like from the outside that the attorney general and the state police are taking a very deliberate approach and are going to be looking very thoroughly through these records. As we've talked about before, you know, we had Bob LeBrant on, among others. There could be a wide range of criminal or civil issues here. We'll just have to wait to see what the evidence uncovers.
And let's be clear to folks listening here, this doesn't happen without a search warrant that's signed by a judge, meaning there's that the judge has been shown probable cause that a crime or crimes have been committed and that there is significant risk of the evidence being not only being on the premises, but being destroyed if this isn't carried out in quick fashion and, you know, with without warning. I think we can both speak from our time in politics and in around government that it's never good when the police kick in your door in the morning and tell you to stand by while they search your premises and then haul away your computers. That usually means that someone's about to, you know, like I said, the shit is going to hit the fan. And, you know, they're not only looking at, I'm sure, Rob and Ann Menard, but how this relates to the former speaker, Lee Chatfield. And, one thing we've talked about on this podcast before is how it relates to the millions of dollars that was going from Chatfield to probably every single member Republican in the House caucus during his time as Speaker and since, including the former Speaker, who's now running for Attorney General, who hired all these the Speaker's family, and when a lot of these things could have taken place. So this scandal still has yet to, I guess, we don't know where all the collateral damage, where all the when all the dust settles, who's going to be singed by this? But this is seems to be just the beginning of the end here, because when something like this happens, by reading all the accounts of this from criminal legal experts, that raids like this done in such public fashion are done to one signal that they're nearing some kind of crescendo in an investigation, and two, to send a message that there's, I think, going to be two kinds of Republicans in Lansing for a while here: cooperating witnesses or soon to be defendants. They're going to have a short window to come forward with what they know. If people have information here that is valuable to this investigation, they need to contact the state police, contact the attorney general, and do so before they become defendants in the case while they still have some leverage. That's my legal advice as a non-attorney.
Well, that's sound advice. Let's turn to another investigation that's going on now. There have been some Michigan-related developments this week. We see that the January 6th panel is continuing its investigation. We know it's been looking into some of these fake electors, Marion Sheridan among them. But this week, we heard that Laura Cox, who people may remember, was the chair of the Republican Party when those fake electors tried to cast their votes by getting into the Capitol. Apparently, she has been subpoenaed now by the January 6th committee. Apparently she had previously spoken to them. That broke down, but now she's being subpoenaed to provide information. What are your thoughts on that, Jeff, from a former insider of the Republican Party here?
Well, I worked obviously very closely side by side in office next to Republican chairman for a number of years, and worked closely with a succession of Republican chairpersons before that and after, and never once were any of them subpoenaed in a criminal, what amounts to an attempt to overthrow the government. So it's usually not a good thing when when you're summoned before the Congress of the United States to say, what do you know about this attempt to overturn an election and illegally keep the person who lost the election in power. The walls seem to be closing in on so many people in Michigan who had different levels of knowledge, different levels of complicity or participation in the planning, the conspiracy to subvert the will of 5.5 million people who voted in Michigan. And, I think that I would imagine that Laura Cox, who is the not only the former party chair, she is a former legislator, former county commissioner in Wayne County, a former federal agent for the Customs or Border Patrol Agency, and the wife of the former Attorney General of Michigan. I would imagine that they're going to be very concerned with following the law, looking at how their reputations come out after this. She would seem to me to be a perfect person to put some squeeze on if I'm the federal investigators looking into this, either from Congress or the DOJ, especially given the animosity that exists between her and the current administration of the party led by Ron Weiser and Michonne Maddock. There's certainly no love lost there. They may hate each other more than either of them hate Gretchen Whitmer and the Democrats.
Yeah, now this is interesting because of all the reports, pictures, Laura Cox did not attempt to get into the Capitol with the rest of the fake electors. The reports were that those electors met and organized themselves over at the Republican Party headquarters, Laura's house at that time. But again, her role in all of this, it's unknown at this point, even though I think weren't there some events where she was with Rudy Giuliani in the immediate aftermath of the election. Do you recall those?
Yeah, well, surrounding the kangaroo court hearings that the House and Senate oversight committees in Lansing had that did the dog and pony shows with Rudy Giuliani and all those crazy attorneys. Where, you know, Rudy gave Trump attorney Jenna Ellis COVID by farting on her. You know, that all happened in Michigan, and Michigan's that was all glorified in infamous Saturday Night Live sketch that Laura referenced today in a statement that she issued. While they were in Michigan doing their clown show in a live stream, I don't know if it was Facebook or, you know, whatever platform it was on, and apparently some other meetings from the MIGOP headquarters, her office, that they had at least allowed the Trump clown attorneys to set up shop in. And so, you know, how deeply she was involved in any of this, who knows, but she was certainly complicit in allowing them to use the party, to use the resources, to use the building, to, you know, help communicate the message, to help disseminate the lie in a way that she tries in her statement to dismiss is you know, doing the partisan battle for her partisan guy. You know, that's one during the course of a campaign is one thing. Using your position and using unlawful extrajudicial powers, or however you want to describe it, to overturn the election goes beyond electioneering, as either you or I have ever practiced it. And any legitimate practitioner in the campaign world would had ever before 2020 sought to practice an election. We didn't fight again a second campaign after Election Day.
Right. Yeah. From what I can tell, you know, she was obviously very involved in the events at the TCS Center. As far as I can tell, she wasn't there, but clearly I was there. And clearly there was an organized effort by the state Republican Party and others to recruit and send observers, challengers, whatever you want to call them, down there. I think there was a sense of kind of panic in the Republican Party here, because I think the election ended up being closer than they thought. It certainly was closer than what the polls indicated. And I'm sure there was a lot of pressure from the White House and Trump to, like, you know, get in there, challenge those votes and so forth. And, but you're right, it's very easy to cross the line from legitimate election activity, legitimate challenges, legitimate monitoring of elections, to outright trying to undo the election, right? Like the Wayne County Board of Canvassers members did, and like we saw with the lawsuits. I don't recall Cox ever being a plaintiff in any of the lawsuits. Clearly, there were Republicans who were. I recall Linda Lee Tarver, among other leaders of the Republican Party, were. But, you know, Cox, at least to her credit, based on what we see and know now, was not visibly involved in those lawsuits, those frivolous lawsuits that have gotten Giuliani and the other lawyers in a lot of trouble as a result. Why don't we switch to another Republican controversy? And that is now, and it's the irony of this, Jeff, and you can tell all the details about this, that there's now a fight going on in the Republican Party inside about how they count the votes at these endorsement conventions. Apparently, a few years ago, your former party switched over to voting machines. But now, of course, in all the paranoia about voting machines, people are questioning whether the machine should be used and whether there should be audits of the vote at the upcoming endorsement convention. What are you thinking about all this?
There's not enough popcorn available for me to just, you know, make and sit by and watch this cannibalism within the party. It's the use of vote counting machines was instituted back when I directed the party. There was a long practice of stand up and vote, which is, you know, fine, and it's done. I believe the Democrats do that. The problem that we were witnessing in the Republican Party at the time was there was a lot of thuggery and intimidation being used to pressure people in their public displays, and a lot of creative counting and outright, I would say, you know, fraud and lies about the totals in various convention races. And so at the time, we switched to a secret ballot there was photo ID, there was a check-in, very similar to going into a precinct and checking in. The elected delegates were allowed to vote. Those votes were counted. There's never been a controversy. The machine spits out the total. There's been a couple of times where a race was close enough. They asked to have what amounts to a check, a hand count of some ballots the Republicans vote by congressional district. That's how they segregate their different voting blocks within their convention. And it has never been controversial until, surprise, now Republicans are conditioned and have been conditioned over the last 15 months or so to not trust votes, to not trust the outcome of any election. And so what they're doing now is saying, we can't trust these votes now because they use this thing that Republicans hate called math. We have
algorithms.
We have 100 people voting. There's 100 votes. They were divided this much for this candidate, this much for the other candidate. My God, look at that sorcery and witchcraft. Who can believe that? And so now it's not just being directed at races of Republicans versus Democrats, where they want to cast doubt on the legitimacy and the outcome of the election. It's Republican on Republican elections within this convention coming up, their endorsement convention on April 23rd, that we're going to now see. They've come up with this, what they think is some kind of Solomon-like solution to, they're going to use the machines, but they're going to also do some hand counting, and they're going to have a committee, a select committee of 27 people, who knows, I don't know why they came up with that number and who they are, who are going to assuage everyone's concerns that everything's on the up and up and legit, and no one's playing around with the numbers and cheating. And it's not going to do anything. Whoever wins is going to claim they were robbed. They're going to fight and scream and yell and claim it was rigged and the machines were wrong and the hand count was rigged. And we'll spend the next the time between April 23rd at their endorsement convention and whenever their nominating convention is in August. I think the Republicans are likely to have the endorsement battle is likely to not end the nomination battle. It's just going to be the first stage, because whoever comes up short is going to probably mobilize in that time between April and August to try to upset whatever happens at the endorsement convention.
Maybe you and I should volunteer to be the outside auditors of these elections.
I'm sure they'd love that. They would love our offer of assistance. So we'll make it right here. If reporters, anybody in the party listening, Mark Brewer and I are more than happy to be the tellers and oversee your election on April 23rd. So we'll even get our good friend, your friend, Bob LeBrant, to help us.
That's right. Well, and I think, it may come as a surprise to our listeners because we're so used to this Michigan political culture. Michigan is quite unique in the way that we nominate down ballot candidates for lieutenant governor, secretary of state, attorney general, the education boards, the Supreme Court. In most states, in virtually every other state, that's done in primaries. So this is remarkable that now in the second decade of the 21st century, we're still doing this the way we've been doing it for decades. It empowers the parties, and I'm a big supporter of political parties and their role, but it really is remarkable that this much power in both parties is concentrated in a few thousand delegates or party members. In the case of the Michigan Democratic Party, any party member can vote at our convention. And I don't think people appreciate, the power they have. And that's why the stakes in these fights that you're describing, Jeff, are so high. This is not about who's going to be the national committee man. This is not about who's going to be the fourth vice chair of the party. This is about who's going to be the public nominee of the Republican Party. Huge stakes and consequences. And I think you're right in your prediction that instead of being the end of some of these nomination fights, this endorsement convention is just going to be the kickoff for an ongoing fight through the August convention.
Yeah, and instead of, you know, 2.1 million people that voted in the last August primary for governor back in 2018, you know, for both parties, you're right. There's a handful of a few thousand delegates. I think it's about 2,000 delegates on the Republican side who are going to be deciding these nominees. And I don't know how many of these delegates are currently drinking their own urine to ward off COVID, but the odds are greater than zero. So these are the kind of people who are selecting the nominees for lieutenant governor, for attorney general and secretary of state. They're injecting themselves with bleach and drinking urine to ward off COVID. And they're making these decisions that will have effect on the millions, 10 million people who live in Michigan.
Yeah, and this is the kind of process that gives people like DiPerno and Caramo a real edge. I think even in today's Republican Party, they'd have a much more difficult time winning a primary than they would have winning a battle among hardcore grassroots activists, the vast majority of whom think the election was stolen from Trump. That's a much easier sell to that audience for them than it would be if they had to go out and raise money and appeal to a much broader electorate. That's going to be their problem if they get nominated. They're going to switch from a few thousand hardcore Trump loyalists to a multi-million person electorate, which is vastly different in the fall. We'll have to see how that all plays out.
And the fate of American democracy hangs in the balance.
Lieutenant Governor Garland Gilchrist joins the conversation after these messages on A Republic If You Can Keep It.
Epic MRA is a Lansing-based market research and public opinion polling firm with nearly four decades of experience accurately measuring public opinion about politics, ballot proposals, and other federal, state, and local issues. Epic MRA is one of the most quoted polling firms in the country. Clients include media outlets, school districts, colleges and universities, state agencies, local governments, labor unions, interest groups and businesses throughout Michigan. Whether it's measuring voter opinion about who's up or down in elections, or if ballot proposals or legislation can earn voter approval, Epic MRA is known as the go-to Michigan pollster. Visit www.epicmra.com to learn more.
Show your support for preserving our republic at the A Republic If You Can Keep It merch store. We've got t-shirts and coffee mugs made to order for lovers of our representative democracy. Just go to our website, arepublicpodcast.com, and click on the merch store button. You aren't fully dressed until you have Ben Franklin on your chest. It's the perfect gift for that democracy lover in your life.
It's a pleasure to welcome my friend, Lieutenant Governor Garland Gilchrist, to the podcast this week. His professional background is in technology, receiving his first computer at age 5 and setting up a computer lab in the Detroit Community Recreation Center using computers that he built himself at age 16, quite remarkable. Lieutenant Governor Gilchrist studied computer engineering and computer science at the University of Michigan, graduating with honors, and later had a successful career as a software engineer at Microsoft, helping to build SharePoint into the fastest growing product in that company's history. Lieutenant Governor Gilchrist spent the next several years of his career as a social entrepreneur and community organizer who helped people in communities across America realize their full economic and political potential.
As part of the Whitmer administration, Lieutenant Governor Gilchrist has sought to address injustice and inequity across our state at every level, co-chairing the Michigan Joint Task Force on Jail and Pretrial Incarceration to leading the Coronavirus Task Force on Racial Disparities. Lieutenant Governor Garland Gilchrist and his wife Ellen reside in Detroit, where they are raising their twins, Emily and Garland III, and daughter Ruby.
Garland, welcome.
Great to be here with you. Happy to do it.
Well, I got to tell you, I'm going to start right out here. Tell us about what kind of work you're doing as Lieutenant Governor. We know you got a big job presiding over the Senate, but what are some of the specific tasks and projects that you've been working on?
Well, I got to keep an eye on the Republican majority in the Senate. That's pretty important. So I try to do my best at that every single day. But, you know, this job is great because it's really the result of a great partnership and relationship with me and Governor Whitmer. The dynamic is very similar to the president and the vice president. You know, I have some constitutional responsibilities, but ultimately it's about how we can work together to move our collective agenda forward. And so certainly, you know, the areas that I've taken a leadership role in the administration thus far have been, you know, reforming our criminal legal system. I've led our criminal justice reform policy efforts, which has been really a huge area of bipartisan consensus and some big progress that I think is going to have a generational impact in our economy and our communities. I'm also our administration's lead on connecting people to high speed, high quality, affordable internet access across communities. I actually, you know, communicated to the president when he was here in November that that my ambition was for Michigan to be the first state to connect all of our people. And so we have resources, thanks in part to their work, the federal level and some good smart organizations at the state level to make that happen. And I've also been working to make sure that we can reduce racial disparities in all their forms when it comes to health outcomes. I led the Michigan Coronavirus Task Force on Racial Disparities, which the state of Michigan, you know, we created that in a way that no other state did to respond to the fact that this virus was killing people of color at a rate way higher than it was killing white people in the beginning. And we needed to do something about that. We didn't let it stand. And our state was the only state in the country to flatten racial disparities and do so to the degree that was measurable and validated by independent researchers. And in fact, the Biden-Harris administration modeled their own COVID equity task force on the work that we did in Michigan. And then the last piece is on, you know, certainly the work to position our people and our economy for success going forward. I'm working within that framework to make sure that Michigan can be just the best place to have an idea, to retain talented people. We have tens of thousands of extremely intelligent, talented college students who come through the state of Michigan. Either they're from here or they come here, and I want them to stay here and do their first thing here, to launch their first business, to get their first job, to catapult their career with that foundation that they got here in Michigan. So I'm really excited about all that and much more, just continuing to have the state of Michigan's back alongside Governor Gretchen Whitmer.
Yeah, now I know you are really unique in many ways as Lieutenant Governor. You come from a tech background, which I think the first time we've ever had a Lieutenant Governor with your kind of technical background. How has that helped you in terms of the broadband work? That is so important, connecting everybody, urban and rural, make sure everybody's got access to the internet nowadays. So important. Can you tell us a bit more about that work?
Yeah, I appreciate that, Marcia. Yes, I'm a software developer by training. I was a double engineering major in computer engineering and computer science at Michigan. And I started my career as a software engineer at Microsoft, helping to grow the SharePoint business to the fastest growing business, still its fastest growing business in the company's history. I worked on that team for 4 years out of college. I've started my own and sold my own technology startups as well before coming into public service. So I do bring that to the work. But on broadband, this is something that really animates me in public service. The first research project I did as a freshman at Michigan was actually on the east side of Detroit, working with a sociology professor to do community-based surveys about what people would do if they had access to the internet on the east side of Detroit in a neighborhood that at that time was not being served by an incumbent internet service provider. And just talking with families about, you know, what would you do with it? How much would you pay for it? What would this unlock for you? And I really just learned a tremendous amount about, you know, frankly, the divide between people who had access and who didn't, and what it would take to cross that. And so I'm proud now. I've worked on that as a community activist and advocate, and now as a public servant, to be able to actually have the resources to connect the 400,000 Michiganders who don't currently have high speed, high quality internet access, to make internet more affordable for people, particularly in our urban and suburban communities, and to raise the floor of digital literacy. I know that it's possible. And my technical background tells me that there are many approaches that we can take to solve this problem, that different approaches are going to work better in different contexts, and we need to be open to all of them. And I have the confidence we can get that done here in Michigan.
I'm just thinking what a contrast that is to the first lieutenant governor I knew well and worked with, Connie Binsfeld, because I don't think she had electricity at her home as late as the 1990s when she became lieutenant governor. So that's quite a generational contrast there in terms of background that you bring to the table. It's been a very busy couple of weeks and a great start to the year for Governor Whitmer and your administration with the State of the State address and the unveiling of this year's budget priorities. Why don't you tell us a little bit about where the administration wants to see policy go in this critical reelection year?
Absolutely. So this is the year to invest in our people and our future, to make sure we can put money in people's pockets. We can deliver on the infrastructure that people need to be safe, to be healthy, and again, to be their best selves and have their ideas grow. So in the budget proposal that we put forward, it addressed all those priorities, $6.3 billion in hard infrastructure. That's roads, buses, trains, bridges, internet access, you name it. We're ready to invest in it and create the good paying jobs that go along with it. When it comes to investing in positioning people for success, for our adults, we have programs like Michigan Reconnect, which are providing tuition free pathways to higher education for everybody in Michigan over the age of 25. The Going Pro program, which is funding employers to do on the job training programs to position people for the new occupations of today and tomorrow. But also, we're investing in our K-12 education system, the biggest investment in the last 20 years in terms of state dollars increase, to increase the per pupil funding for every student, to invest in everything you want to invest in education, literacy programs, to invest in career technical education, to invest in pathways to apprenticeships, to invest for programming for children with extraordinary needs, and really in a timely way, given that everyone's been experiencing during this pandemic, particularly young people like my twin third graders, making a historic investment in mental and behavioral health support for our young people in Michigan. School-based behavioral health support professionals, actually creating incentives for more people to enter that profession by revolutionizing our student loan repayment program here in Michigan, to recruit hundreds more to be based in buildings. Because, you know, as a parent, I've said I don't know to my children more in the last 2 years than I ever thought I would. They need somebody to talk to, and it's not always going to be me. And so having adults who are trained, who are professional, who know how to meet them where they are when they're in school, can complement me as a parent working with them when they're at home. And so we're really proud of that historic investment that we're making in this budget too. And then I also want to call out the fact that, you know, I talk about putting money in people's pockets. So we're doing that in a number of ways. In the budget, we're doing something where we actually are providing bonuses to the professionals who've been keeping life going during this pandemic, our educators, but everyone who's working on those front lines, people who are working in sanitation and healthcare, utility workers, grocery stores, those people who are making things happen while we were all trying to stay safe. We have a thank you bonus to all of them. And we also are, you know, undoing some of the things that Republicans broke in Michigan, frankly, when we come to our tax system, making it more fair. You know, 10 years ago, Republicans in Michigan decided to cut taxes for big corporations by increasing taxes on people's retirement and increasing taxes on working families. So we, instead of tripling the earned income tax credit and rolling back the retirement tax on people's retirement income. And this one, that last one is real. Like, my dad tells me about his number that gets taxed on his pension every time I talk to him. Every single conversation, like it's a broken record. I know his number. And we want to make sure that we can fix that number for, you know, 500,000 Michiganders who are getting hit by that pension tax that they should have never got hit with in the first place. So this budget will do that too.
That's great. I was still a Republican insider back when we did that. And so my dad says the same thing to me and doesn't let me forget it. So it's time for a change.
No doubt.
Arlen, if I may, can you talk to us about what you think the impact is going to be of these modernized factories that are going to produce electric vehicles and electric batteries in Michigan? I mean, again, you've got this great tech background. Tell us what you see the future being with these kind of investments.
Well, I'm just glad that the state of Michigan continues to be the epicenter of how we define mobility in the nation and in the world. You know, I was privileged to be part of the General Motors Factory Zero announcement back in 2019, and then have that come full circle that after the president signed the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, to come in the first place he went to talk about that was GM Factory Zero in November of last year, where they will be building the all-electric Hummer vehicles. And then they have the historic General Motors announcement a few weeks ago, where they'll be creating a battery plant in the Lansing area, building the electric Silverado and GMC Sierra at their Lake Orion plant. We're excited about what this means and what it represents. But I think it shows two things. One, that Michigan's workforce, we have more engineers in Southeast Michigan than any other region in the country. There is no place in the world that can build and design like we build and design here. And I think these investments are a recognition of that. And they lay a foundation for not just the OEMs and the big three, but that, you know, every single element of the value chain for our mobility future, cars, electric bikes, scooters, unmanned aerial vehicles, there is engineering prowess. There's testing and deployment infrastructure. There's scalability opportunity that exists for every player in that market in the state of Michigan, whether it's the unmanned aerial vehicle and drone testing facility we have at Gerald R. Ford Airport in Grand Rapids, Michigan, the American Center for Mobility at Willow Run Airport in Ypsilanti. We have everything you need to make that business grow and make it work. And you can test it all four seasons. You know, you want to have your vehicle be smart and autonomous. It has to be able to handle snow. You can't get that in Arizona, but you can get that here in the state of Michigan. So we're proud of that infrastructure that we've built, that our budget continues to invest in, and that companies are going to want to come to be near and to utilize to take full advantage as we define mobility for the next 100 years.
Yeah, it's really exciting. I mean, just like we had the first paved roads here in Michigan in the country, we're now going to have this highway, I understand, about a mile's worth, where you can recharge your electric vehicle as you drive over it. And that's just amazing.
Yeah, it's leadership. It's leadership that we're showing here because, again, we're not here to maintain the status quo in this industry. We're here to press it forward because our people are that forward leaning. We have thinkers who are that creative and who are that ingenuitive. And so we're going to do that and continue to be on the knife's edge of that, whether it's on autonomous, connected, shared, electrified mobility, whether it's revolutionizing what public transit looks like in this future of mobility environment. And I'm saying that as a transit rider. Like, I was a transit rider up until the day I took office. And so in the city of Detroit with my family, my wife, and then two children. So, you know, I've seen the seams of that system. And that's why I'm proud of that. You know, we're going to invest another $100 million in transit from the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act. And we're really proud of what that represents as well.
Yeah, so that Ford campus, I'm sorry, did that Ford campus down in Detroit, that's going to be a huge shot in the arm for the city, and it's just going to reinforce everything that you're talking about there. I mean, that could become a tech hub in and of itself, don't you think?
Absolutely. It's going to draw talent. It's going to draw talent here to the region, whether it's investments like that at Michigan Central Station, whether it's investments like the Detroit Center for Innovation, that's a partnership with the University of Michigan and Olympia that's going to be in downtown Detroit. I'm really excited about what this represents for the city and in turn the state.
Yeah, great future.
Let's jump into our time machines and say that you come back and talk to us next February. You've won re-election. What has transpired during the year? Where do you see the state if you're able to implement these budget priorities, able to fulfill these policy objectives and have a successful election campaign? You know, how would you be setting the table looking back at 2022 and setting the stage for the second term at that point?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think our reelection one will represent that the people of Michigan recognize that we are laying the foundation for the future, and they do not want to interrupt that with extremist ideology. That instead, they want people who are focused on them, focused on their families and their issues, on making sure they have money in their pockets, food on their table, that all four wheels will stay on their car when they drive, and that we'll be in a position to have our ideas thrive here in the state of Michigan. And so talking to you now, a year from now, we're going to talk about how we have more families connected to the internet, more people able to take advantage of telemedicine. We have children who are closer to reading at grade level and have an adult to talk to if they have questions or concerns about anything in their life who they can trust. And I think we're going to be in a position where we have more people starting more businesses here in the state of Michigan because of the economic development packages that we passed and the supports that we have for people in all different communities in the state of Michigan who know that their ideas have a chance here. That's the kind of potential people we'll be voting for, and that's what we're going to make into a reality.
Kyle, and you and the governor have been real champions of protecting the right to vote, right? Throughout this entire era, we've seen so many attacks on it. Tell us a little bit about your work and where you see that going forward.
I think this is existential, Mark. You know, and for those who don't know, look, I entered public life running to be the election administrator in Detroit in 2017. This actually was my first foray into this, which was unsuccessful. But I share that because I think it shows how much I care about people's access to democracy. People's full access to the freedom and flexibility to vote in a way that works for them so that their voice can be heard. And I'm proud of what Michigan has done in this realm. In 2018, we voted to expand access to voting in a really amazing way. And to see the Republican Party in Michigan be so hell-bent and so jealous of the voter suppression that's happened in other states to try to recreate it here is really disheartening. And it shows me that You know, their party's not focused on people participating in the political process. They're trying to pull people out of it. Well, the biggest difference between me and a Republican on that is I want more people to participate. I want more people to vote. And so that's why we have certainly, the governor has vetoed any legislation that is, that has been even connected to the premise that there was a problem with the last election, that the election was stolen from the former president. It was not. And that has been proven time and time and time and time again. And that the Republican attempts to, you know, frankly, just corrupt the voting process by making it more difficult for people from so many walks of life to participate in the process, shows you they actually don't care about voters' values because they don't care about their votes. And so that's why we're working. That's why the stakes are so high in this election, because make no mistake about it, myself and the governor and the attorney general and secretary of state, us being in place, that's what protected the integrity of the outcome of the election last year. I presided over the Electoral College in December of 2020. I saw this with my own eyes, saw what happened and what that threat could have looked like. And we pulled forward because we backstopped democracy here in the state of Michigan. And we need to continue that. There's so many groups that are working right now on affirmative petitions to put in front of voters, or proposals to put in front of voters, that like we did in 2018, voters are seeing when you get a chance to vote on expanding access to voting. People typically support that. And that's something I think we're going to see tested here again in 2022.
Yeah, even as you were presiding over the Electoral College vote, we had those criminal fake electors trying to get into the Capitol so they could cast those fake votes. And we're seeing how that scandal and investigation is playing out as well. It's just remarkable, the period that we're going through here.
That's right.
Well, I know that we are out of time, and I wanted to thank you, Lieutenant Governor Garland Gilchrist, for joining us this week.
Jeff, thank you so much. Mark, thank you for having me. Really enjoyed it and appreciate what y'all are doing, bringing some fun and levity and some rigor to all these conversations.
All right. Well, you keep up the good work.
All right.
We're out of time for this week. Our great thanks to Lieutenant Governor Garland Gilchrist for joining the conversation.
If you'd like to be part of the conversation, send us an email. comments@arepublicpodcast.com.
And if the Republic is still standing, we'll be back in a week. I'm Mark Brewer.
And I'm Jeff Timmer. See you next week.
You can subscribe to A Republic If You Can Keep It on your favorite podcast app. A Republic If You Can Keep It is a production of Michigan Citizens for a Better Tomorrow.